Today we're going to be talking about the treatment of the hostile, angry couple. And mostly what I'm going to do is try to teach you principles, because couples therapy is an art, and it's an art where you're working with the interplay between you and the couple, between the partners and each other, and definitely working to support their development. And before we get in to specific issues that are relevant for the hostile, angry couple, I wanted to just take a minute to talk about the overall tasks in a developmental model, or an overall way of thinking about what you're doing. Now, obviously, you're not doing all of these things at any one time, and if you started trying to think of all these things at once, you would drive yourself crazy. But this is in the back of my head, and I think it can be in the back of your head in terms of getting a better grip and understanding on what you're doing. And so I think of it as, with every single couple who comes in, there's tremendous developmental potential that exists both in the individuals and definitely in the relationship. And so how you involve yourself with the partners and how you involve yourself with the relationship will be designed to push their development. And so we've talked a lot about diagnosing the developmental stage. So for today's class, we know that we'll be talking about the hostile, angry couple, but with any couple you're working with, the more you have an understanding of their stage, the more you can tailor interventions to the developmental impasse, and that built into your interventions and built into the steps you take will be a recognition of that impasse and what you're doing to help the couple get unstuck. And so, in a way, you're conveying a sense that positive development is possible and keeping yourself out of the hopelessness that they may bring to you. And so, again, the diagnostic stage and the attachment styles that we've also been discussing will be your guiding light. And lots, one sec. Oh. So you're going to be supporting progression, not regression, and that can be any time in any session. When the couple starts to fall into serious doom and gloom or despair, unless it's really a couple that is ending and they're there to end, you can look at interventions that are going to lead them out of that kind of regression. We've talked before about helping partners stop triggering and traumatizing one another so that they can handle the anxiety of differentiation. And I'll do a little more on that today, and Pete will do more on Monday. And then the last two things on this list of tasks are things that we'll get to in later sessions. But the more you have an appreciation for the internal conflicts that are interfering with their development, the more you'll be able to work with specific partners on those internal conflicts to get them unstuck. And you'll also be facilitating learning specific developmental skills that are appropriate for the stage that the couple is stuck at. So in our last session, we looked at how the couple presents, and I put kind of a summary slide here about how they present, but we did a whole hour on that last time. But remembering that in the hostile, angry couple, they can be both actively angry, or one may be much more passive-aggressive and not look so overtly angry or rageful. But they will have a history of hurtful, traumatic moments between them. You'll often see them fight or bristle in the sessions. There's lots of projection. And these are couples that may have a lot of history of drug and alcohol problems. And particularly with the hostile, angry couple, I wanted to mention a little bit more about the initial assessment, because there are some angry, acting out couples where couples therapy is not the treatment of choice to begin with. And those are ones where there is an active addiction, and particularly active addiction that's acknowledged, because sometimes couples come into treatment where that's the secret agenda, that they're hoping that you will help them recognize, or help one partner recognize it and begin to do something about it. But with a couple where the drug and alcohol use is very known, they're discussing it, they're describing it, it's substantial, you may be looking at referring them to AA or even to an inpatient program before they're ready for couples work. You also may have to assess the level of violence if there has been violence in the couple. And definitely for a couple where there is a history of violence and the violence is egosyntonic to one member of the couple, this is not a couple that's going to be appropriate for couples therapy and would be much better off for each partner to be in some individual work first. So I gave you some assessment questions. I'm not going to go over those right now, but I gave you some assessment questions that you can use to look at the intensity of the anger, the level of the anger, and also the level of violence, and so that you can decide whether or not it is a couple that you want to see in couples therapy. But for today, let's talk about the couples who have either no violence or maybe have had one incident of violence that's been was very ego dystonic. And so, but they fight a lot. They're chronic. There's a lot of bitterness, a lot of hostility, a lot of anger. So those are the couples we'll be talking about today. And with these couples, as much as possible at the beginning of therapy, I like to do longer sessions. And definitely a double session for the first session, if at all possible in the way that you work. But the reason for the longer session at the beginning, and it doesn't have to be a full double session as you get into it, it could be a session and a half, but there's a real ebb and flow to each session, and you don't want to leave open wounds at the end of a session if you can avoid it at all possible. And so I think of the ebb and flow as one where it takes a little while at the beginning to identify the direction for the session. Whenever possible, you want the couple to be working with each other in the session, and so it takes a bit of time to structure that and help them engage with each other. And then you're working through whatever the problem is or the trauma or the skill development until they can cycle back into a sense of connection. And so because there is almost an ebb and flow and you get an intuitive sense and feeling about that, and it can take a while. So I like to give myself initially a little bit more than a 50-minute hour. Then also early in therapy, the partners really feel an acute need to feel heard, helped, and responded to by you. They're really looking both for direction from you and a sense of compassion from you. And you want to have time at the beginning to do that with both people, not just with one of the partners. Later on, you can move to a 50-session process, and that's fine. Another thing I like to do in one of the early sessions is they're usually giving you a long list of all the bad things that have gone on and the problems and what's been difficult for them. And I want to say something like, I know you haven't been able to tell me yet everything that's gone wrong or everything that's been difficult for you, but I'd also like to hear a bit about the good parts of the relationship. And then when they're telling me about the good parts, I'm listening to that in two ways. One is diagnostic. I'm listening to see whether they can maintain something positive for more than a couple of seconds and how long they can stay with something positive. But I'm also looking and listening for how I can use the positive parts as leverage to build on and to create motivation for the work that we'll do. So I'm listening to whether the positive parts are all in the distant past, whether there's some positive that's going on right now in the present, and definitely if there's positive going on in the present, that is something you can build on or encourage more of. And is there a positive hope for the future? And is that positive hope for the future something, again, that has a lot of real potential, or is it very, very idealized? But the positive hope for the future can be a place where you can start to build in accountability. Because if they do want that positive future, then you can help them take a look at there are ways and things they can do to be accountable to themselves and to each other to help to bring about that future. Another principle for managing the sessions is that I want to be aware of how I'm allocating the time and the attention. Not so much because I think it should be equal, and not so much because I won't ever take sides, but because I want to be able to be clear with the couple that I know what I'm doing and why, and that I'm clear about how I'm allocating the time. So if I'm focusing a lot more on one person, I might say, today I want to focus more on Joe. I'd like to get more of your history, Joe, and I'd like to understand some things about what happened to you before the two of you got together. Or I might be saying, I want to focus more on you, Joe, because it seems like you get very easily upset when your wife is upset about household chores, and I'd like to get a better understanding of that dynamic. And then next week, Alice, I'll spend some time exploring your experience more completely. So again, I'm explicit with them that I recognize what I'm doing. And with the very, very competitive hostile, angry couples, embedded in what I'll say or weave through some of the interventions is the sense that it takes two, that I'm not seeing this as one person's fault, but much more that it's an interplay between them, and that I want them to know that I know that. It's also true that working with these couples over time takes a lot of confrontation. And so it means that you'll be pushing yourself to be more confrontive, but confrontive in a descriptive way, and very observant and aware of how they're responding to your confrontations. So, you know, I'm definitely observing the nonverbal cues. I'm paying attention to reactions that I think they're having, to countertransference reactions that I might be having. And I want to ask things like, how are you feeling about what I'm saying? And get a gauge even on how comfortable or uncomfortable they are with what I'm saying. So I might even ask them to rate it on a 10-point scale. Sometimes these partners, particularly some of the passive-aggressive ones, can be very quiet in a session, can be having an extreme reaction to something that you're saying or doing, and not say a word about it in the room, and then leave you a hostile message or want to quit therapy or something like that. So I want to do some checking so that I don't get blindsided and that I'm not shocked or surprised by anything that's happening. So I'm gauging, particularly when I'm confronting, I'm gauging how they're responding to it. And then if they don't like what I'm doing, I especially want to give positive strokes for their directness, if they are direct with me. These are couples who can't handle honesty very well and can't handle differentiation very well. So if they can start to be self-defined with me, particularly if they do it in a way that's not attacking, that's a way to start building up, hey, this is a safe place, this is a place where honesty is not something that's going to be responded to with an attack. And if they think I've made a mistake, I want to be authentic. So if they think I've made a mistake and I think maybe I have too, I'm willing to say, you know, I think you're right. That wasn't such a good idea, or that wasn't so smart. So that I see that it's okay for me to make mistakes if I can comfortably own them. Or if there's a time when I'm really asking them to do an experiment, like the paper exercise, if you were asking them to experiment with doing that and it didn't go so well for some reason, you could say, this was an experiment and I was hoping that we would be able to learn a lot about your dynamics, and for some reason it just didn't work out so well today, or whatever it is, so that you're not evidencing lots of defensiveness in the session.
You're modeling accountability for them?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think actually this is a good place to pause and see if Judy or Claudia have any comments or questions before I jump into like ways that you're going to target change in these couples.
So, Claudia, I don't have any questions right now. I find that being authentic and being able to constantly be checking in, the more I do that, the more safe I've noticed both partners can be.
Mm-hmm. So you do a lot of that in your work?
I do a lot of that, yeah.
Okay, great.
Nothing from me. This is Judy.
Okay. Ellen, I had something I was going to ask you. When you're
sure.
working with a really hostile, dependent couple and you have to, you know, interrupt a lot and do a lot of confronting, do you let them know that ahead of time to sort of set the stage and say, you know, just so you know, I'm going to be interrupting you a lot throughout the session, if that's okay, just in the interest of keeping things on track?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
I may say I'm going to do it in the interest of keeping us on track. I may be doing it even in the interest of getting more accomplished in the limited amount of time we have. I may say to them, if you're having trouble with me interrupting you, please tell me. But I do want to give myself lots of permission to interrupt when I think we're going off in a tangent or a direction that's not going to be that fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine, too, that you have to watch out for the re-injuring types of behaviors. So you want to interrupt those if they start to occur.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And especially in the early phase of treatment, when they don't even understand yet that those behaviors are so injuring to each other, you want to be as active as possible in interrupting those as quickly as you can.
And it seems like they really want you to do that. You know, they're showing you in the session where they're stuck, and they're really hoping that you'll do something and to stop it when they're doing it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the biggest complaint that we hear from couples that are referred to the Couples Institute is that our previous therapist didn't provide enough structure or didn't stop us, and all we did was fight. We came in and we did exactly what we do at home. And they really are coming in so that they don't do what they do at home.
Ellen, this is Judy. Could you give an example of how you might stop that, what you would say?
Stop
if they're getting into the fighting, the same sort of pattern that they do at home,
like re-injuring.
Yeah, re-injuring. I mean, first of all, I will usually say, wait, stop. Let's all stop. Take a deep breath. Let's get centered. And I go slow and kind of center the room first in a way, and then I usually will be descriptive about this is what I'm seeing happen. And I'll describe what I see happen, and then I try to illuminate the feelings that I think are underneath what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll say, it looked to me like, Joe, you said something that was painful to Alice. Alice, I could kind of see the pain in your eyes, but then what I heard you say was something kind of aggressive back to Joe. And then, Joe, I'm noticing that you're reacting to that. So, and then I'll try to talk about the pain and the hurt. And and I'm going to get into in a few minutes some more about educating them about the whole issue of how they do traumatize each other. So I think this is a good point to go on to areas to target change. And what I did on one of your slides was I gave you a list of all the major things that I think make a difference over time in creating substantial change in a hostile dependent couple, and change that's not the kind of change that's not superficial and that will enable them really to move into a successful process of differentiation and into changing the core dynamic. So for today, so just quickly, they are, the things on there are containing conflict, continually disrupting symbiosis, repairing relationship ruptures, increasing the capacity to handle differentiation, disengaging projection, and then re-engaging a new behavior that developed the self-capacities that address the developmental arrest. So that's seven different things, and obviously you're not doing them all at the same time. But I think what I'm hoping that you'll all leave by the end of the course with is a real substantial sense of what these seven things are. And, you know, it's going to be woven in. It's not, there's not a cookie cutter approach for exactly when you do which, but these seven make an enormous, enormous difference over time in changing these couples. So for today, I'm going to spend some time on the whole issue of containing conflict. And the reason for that is that when they first come in, that's what you see. I mean, that's what's in front of you, is their fighting and their conflict. And they're often pretty desperate. And so you do need some ways to contain conflict. And we've talked already a lot about goal setting. And goal setting is one very useful way to start containing conflict. But it has a major problem with these couples. More than any other type of couple that you see, these partners resist setting individual self-focused goals. And they will move away from you, they will avoid you, they will do things to not want to set goals that really ask for accountability from them. Sometimes they may say goals like, I just want to be accepted for who I am, and that's a goal for the other person. It's not a goal for themselves. Or they'll say, I don't want to be criticized anymore. Again, that's a goal for the partner. So you have to be very vigilant about making sure, if you're using goals as a way to interrupt the conflict, you have to be sure that the goals that each person is setting are really individual self-focused goals, and not goals over which they have no influence. If you let them set a goal over which they have no influence and the partner keeps doing the same old thing, it will increase the level of helplessness and hopelessness, and they'll come in repeatedly more discouraged. And so I sometimes think that one of the easiest ways to think about the goal part, particularly around containing conflict, is just very simply, what do they want to stop doing and what do they want to start doing? And the more chaotic the couple is, the more simple you can make this. I mean, where you really try to just get it down to, I want to stop yelling and I want to start counting to 10, getting a grip on myself, thinking about what I might be afraid of as well as mad about, would be a pretty short, succinct way of saying a stop doing and a start doing. Another problem in the goal setting is that these partners really confuse developmental change with behavioral change. So they need developmental change, and we all know that, but they will ask for change from each other. So they'll say, like, I want my partner to express more emotion, or I'd like my partner to be more intellectual. And they're asking for something that's developmental and will have to take place over time, but they treat it as if it's a behavioral change. So they treat it as if they should be able to, it should be as easy as learning to tie a pair of shoes. And so, I mean, I think it's part of our role to really talk about the developmental nature of what they're asking. And so what they're asking isn't wrong. It's not bad. And in fact, they're usually things that would enrich the relationship. But they have to understand that they have a role to play in helping to create it. they have to understand that it's going to take some time, and unless, and that the partner would not be moving in that direction if they weren't requesting it. And so, you know, unlike individual therapy where people go in and they get to ask to work on what they themselves want to change, when you're in couples therapy, you often have an unmotivated partner who's being asked to change something that they would never care twice about changing if the other person didn't ask them to do it. And so part of the process when we ourselves are involved in goal setting as a therapist is to be able to talk to them about the fact that this is going to take some time, and it's a good thing, but it's you're asking for a real stretch from the other person. And again, since we've talked about goal setting before, I don't want to spend a lot of time, but I've given you a bunch of questions here on some of the slides that you can be asking in a session that will help you get to good goals. I also gave you an example from another couple that I saw where I used a homework assignment, which was what did they want to stop doing, what did they want to start doing, what did they want to understand, and what did they want, what was most urgent to them that we do first. And so you can look at those in terms of how Tom responded, and that was with some work. It didn't come in this clear right away when I first asked him to take it home and write it. And then Rhonda, what she came back with and what we worked out. Rhonda was somebody who was a major, major withdrawer, and also somebody with an abuse history who did a lot of dissociating. And so she had very strong, powerful feelings, but they were never processed with him. And so when she didn't process anything with him, instead she would end up regressing into a pretty young, vulnerable state and feel enormously desperate. And so when you look at her goals, you know, she says, I want to start sharing my feelings and persevering more. I want to understand how to push through feelings without giving up. And it's urgent to practice processing feelings with him. And it, in her case, it was very urgent that we do a lot in terms of processing with him because, like I said, she went into such a withdrawn, dissociative state and would get so regressed. And the initial things that would be the triggers were not things that were actually that difficult to solve between them, but she just had no experience whatsoever of processing anything directly with a partner. I guess one more thing. If you move ahead to the slide that says establishing ground rules as a way of containing conflict. And I gave you a handout in the other part of the handouts that's actually a form that you can just print out and use. And it's a form for setting, helping couples set limits and boundaries on conflict. And it's four questions, and each person needs to fill it out before they show it to the other person. This exercise is particularly useful for very chaotic and very disorganized couples. This is an exercise where you are providing about as much structure as you can. I mean, where you're giving an exercise that's very structured, you're making them work on it in a very structured way, and you're cutting through some of the chaos and disorganization by actually asking them to focus on this. And so the first question is, for me, it is acceptable to do the following during a fight. And so you're asking somebody to reflect on what do they think is acceptable for them to do. So if they think it's acceptable to yell, they should put down yelling. If they think it's an acceptable thing to storm out of the room, they should put that down. If they think it's acceptable not say a word and shut down and withdraw, then that needs to be on there. But, I mean, obviously you're hoping that they're going to put a lot of positive things here, but because people's defensive self-protective reactions are what come out in a fight, they will do what they think is acceptable to them. So I'd rather have them make it explicit in terms of what they actually believe is acceptable. Then you're also asking them to put down what's not acceptable. And so you may have things like, it's not acceptable to throw things, it's not acceptable to break things, it's not acceptable to leave the house, or whatever they might think is unacceptable for them to do. And then questions 3 and 4 have to do with their desire about what they hope is the case for the other person. So for the partner, they're hoping, it is acceptable to me, for example, if I was filling it out, I would say it's acceptable to me that Pete raised his voice, but I might put it's not acceptable for him to swear at me. Or I might put it's acceptable for my partner to ask for a time out, but it's not acceptable that we never have the conversation come up again. And so after they have filled it out, then you want to, again, and this is especially the case the more chaos the couple's in and the more disorganization, then you want to come back in the room and see which ones you can come to some agreement about. And this is where you have to use your judgment well, because if they're asking for something that you know the other person will never, ever do and comply to, and the other person is, in fact, resisting it, it's better not to put it on an initial list, because I don't want to have failure experiences. I would much rather have it a short list with some beginning small changes that they're going to be able to be successful with, that you're going to be able to stroke, that you're going to have them be able to stroke each other as you're starting to change a chronically hurtful system. With one couple that I saw, one of the main agreements that they made, and this sounds kind of funny, but she said that she wanted it no longer to be acceptable for him to say to her, "Yes, Gretchen, no, Gretchen." And Gretchen was his mother's name. And so she would, you know, he would go whenever he was annoyed with her, he'd call her Gretchen, which would really incite her. And so one of the first things that they put into the unacceptable was the yes, Gretchen, no, Gretchen idea. So let me pause again and,
Helen, can I interrupt for a second?
Sure, yeah.
It's Claudia?
Yeah.
I did this last night with a couple.
Great.
And it was so powerful. Now, granted, this couple is sort of unusual in that they're not, you wouldn't really call them a hostile dependent couple, because it's only when they get into a very stressful, chaotic situation and they start to fight that they just have they've never been able to do it well. And partly because he withdraws, because he's terrified of any energy coming at him. And she feels, these are both from their family systems, she feels invisible. And so the more invisible she feels, the more escalated she becomes. And the more escalated she becomes, the more he withdraws. And he finally just says, yes, dear, fine, whatever you want, whatever. And it was just, they have wonderful senses of humor. But that's where we ended last night, where the two big things was that he was going to really work at saying that he needed space and taking it, rather than withdrawing and shutting down, and that she was not going to just storm out of the room and mumble to herself, that she would say, I feel I need to take a break, and he would allow it, because he would get so uncomfortable with her saying she wanted to take a break that he would pursue her. So it was fascinating what it brought up.
And what, like, by the end of it, you felt like it was powerful.
And yeah.
What... Can you say anything more about what just felt powerful to you about what happened in the room?
What happened in the room was, it was like just an epiphany in a way, because he suddenly, in the description of what was acceptable or not for him, could see that he himself was giving himself away instantly, that he would do anything to get rid of the possible eruption on her part. And it was like what I'd been, I mean, I've been dancing around this with him for quite a while, and suddenly he got it.
That's terrific.
And suddenly she was willing to take responsibility for the sense of being invisible, and that that's where the need to escalate came from. And he heard her escalation in a whole different way, because he had a sense of where it was coming from. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, that's terrific. That's terrific, and it's a really great example. This exercise can be very powerful. It's one, I know in some of my consultation groups, some therapists have said to me, well, it's so much structure, or, you know, it's kind of a boring exercise. But for when you have experiences like the one you're describing, then you know it's not boring to them.
And it wasn't boring for them, nor was it boring for me.
Right.
Although I have to say, you know, I have another couple in mind who are, I think, really fit the category of hostile dependent. And the level of disconnect and fighting and lack of individual self-awareness, not to mention couple awareness, is so intense that I think it would be very hard to do this with them. They would have to be so motivated. I mean, the couple I was working with last night are just so completely motivated. So I guess I wonder about how it would work with a couple that's just so angry that they're not motivated.
I have had the experience with couples who seem not motivated when you, like, really sit on them to do a, you know, you could break it down to just two of these instead of four of them. And ask them to, you know, I mean, first you have to say, are you here to really do anything? I mean, if they're not there to do anything, then you're not going to get anywhere. But if they are there to do something, then being strong about, you know, we got to start somewhere. And if each of you waits for the other one to go first, we're not going to get anywhere. And so let's look at whether there is something that you do now when you're fighting that's inciting your partner that you're willing to stop doing.
And I suppose it might be one way to approach it to help them get into it more would be to say, all right, can you say what is unacceptable for your partner to do and what is acceptable, and start from that direction rather than themselves? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. And that gets into, we'll get to it in a minute, but that gets into really getting a sense of what is most triggering for the other person. Because if they can stop doing the thing that's the most painful or the biggest trigger, then that's going to give you and them the most leverage. I mean, I'll give an example now from me and Pete. When we got together, you know, I had a mom who could be incredibly passive, and was especially passive in some significant incidents where I really needed her to help me interface with the school that I went to, and she was very, very passive. And so when Pete gets overloaded with too many tasks or too much to do, he can get shut down and look very passive. And so I would be reactive to his passivity, or what I perceived as passivity. And he had a very, very critical dad. And so he would be very reactive to any sense that I was getting annoyed with him or upset with him. And so, you know, at the core of how we would trigger each other would be, me having a difficult time managing any sense of passivity, and him having a difficult time managing any sense of criticism. And so when you understand what those triggers are, you can also help the couple more.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about disrupting symbiosis, and we'll do much more on this in the session in January, at the beginning of January, on conflict avoidance, because it's very crucial in that arena as well. But the true hostile dependent couple has lots of both symbiotic and fused expectations. The most common one that we've all seen a ton of times is the expectation of mind reading.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have to pick and choose
when you confront symbiotic interactions and symbiotic expectations that are going on. But in order to really successfully change these couples, you're looking at developing a much clearer sense of an individual self, which they often don't have. And one of the easiest ways to begin doing this is when they're using the word we. And you get a lot of things like, we have a communication problem, or, you know, we don't listen, or any of those kinds of things that people say often. So usually what I might like to do is pick one of those at a time when they're not really riled up and say, would you do an experiment with me for a minute, and ask them to turn it into an I statement. So if somebody says, we have a communication problem, I might say, would you try out saying, I have a problem being more open with Sally. And I ask the person to say it out loud and then check in on terms of what they experience and feel when they do that. And this is where you get, again, a large continuum that's quite diagnostic. The very most extreme example of a couple that I ever worked with, the first time I asked him if he would say I instead of we, he started yelling at me, and he said, I absolutely will not. I speak for her, I always speak for her, and you are never to address me individually again, or her.
Wow.
And it was so intense and so strong. Now that's one end of the continuum, and other people will be much more able to say to you, oh, it feels a little odd, or, oh yeah, that might be true. And so it helps you get even a sense of where they are on a differentiation continuum when you start to move in to disrupt, the symbiosis. Another way that you can begin disrupting it is, you know, often they'll be telling you about how bad the other person is. And you have to have a way to acknowledge that what their partner does is a problem, and that you're not discounting the level, the fact that the other person, what the other person is doing to trigger them is a real issue, a real problem. But I want to also have a way to say, but it, when I'm talking with you and I'm helping you, it isn't the problem for you. The problem in this case for you is that you have a restricted response range. Like, you don't have options in terms of how you respond to the trigger once you've been hurt. And so that if we're going to move forward again, I want to help people develop a wide range of options in terms of how they respond to those painful, hurtful interactions. And I put kind of a funny cartoon up here from Sally Forth where she says, I want your honest opinion, Ted. And he says, okay, but first you have to sign this release form. Because to get that kind of honest, open dialogue, partners are often really afraid to expose that they're in pain or expose that they're hurt to the other person, because they think it's going to make things even worse. And, you know, it's a process that goes on of us stroking and nudging and being able to help them take those risks of being more honest with one another. And I've put up next, like, there's a series of slides about repairing relationship ruptures.
Excuse me, Ellen, this is Judy. Yes. Could I just interrupt real quick before you
sure.
go on back to the example you gave of the man that said, we don't ever address me as I?
Uh-huh.
Were you ever able to break through that?
What?
Or help
what
them?
What I was able
How
to do
How did you
was,
respond?
Well, I was so stunned when that happened, and it was earlier in my career too. So, in that session, I just kind of went along with what he was saying. I didn't challenge him more because I didn't think I was going to get anywhere. And in the next session, I was testing out a little bit more in terms of whether they could handle any differentiation, and it became clear that he didn't want any, and that their daughter, it was a couple and family situation. The daughter was very caught in it. In the course of therapy, what I did succeed in doing was helping the daughter be able to leave home successfully. What I didn't succeed with them was ever changing the couple's pattern.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, too long-term and too severe in that particular case.
Thanks.
Sure. So there's a couple of slides here about repairing relationship rupture and the limbic system. And, you know, the first thing here is the whole education piece about helping couples understand that when they're fighting, it's basically, what I have here is it's dueling amygdalas. I mean, it's both persons' amygdala in their brain that is being triggered. And when they're dueling like that, if they can't help calm the system down, they're not going to get anywhere. And they're not going to get anywhere that's successful. So, an example that I sometimes use that helps people visualize it is if when you were a child, your house burned down and all your toys and all your clothes and everything was destroyed in a fire, when somebody lights a match or you're near anything that's much of a fire, you're going to be frightened. And there's not much you can do to stop that. There's going to be just a level of extra vigilance about fire. And that seems to be an image that a lot of couples can grasp. And so I'll talk to them about how you are, and I sometimes will talk to them about how my mother's passivity created, you know, a limbic kind of scanning in me for passivity and difficulty and pain, because that was the time that I felt so deserted by my mother. And so that is a painful experience for me. And I think couples appreciate it when you're willing to share something from your own experience that's a little bit mm-hmm. vulnerable and open with them. And it makes this a universal. It makes it part of being human. It makes them not pathological. It makes them not be a problem. And so if they can begin to understand that, if they can develop a process for calming that emotional brain before they try to solve problems, they get into this whole thing where they're trying to solve a problem, they're trying to solve logistics, they're trying to solve whether they love each other or not, all in a moment where one or both of them have very little prefrontal cortex thinking going on. And they're just in a kind of raw pain. So, you know, Pete talked about this in his session, and he'll talk more about it on Monday. But I'm going to go through another example of a process that I use with couples as a way of beginning to deal with this. And I say to them, When you get triggered by something that the other person says or does, if you can say ouch, if you can say I hurt or ooh or ouch or some word that is acceptable in the dyad, that it's okay to acknowledge that there was just a moment of painful interaction. Or you might say something happened where I'm starting to get defensive. Then it's even better if you can identify and express the pain. So, for example, if you can say, ooh, what you said felt hurtful, it felt bad to me, and I'm feeling that about an 8 on a 10-point scale. That alerts your partner that this was a big one. Or you might say it's only a 2, but it registered. but they have a way to let each other know how bad it was on that scale. And then if the partner is willing to soothe the pain rapidly, to be able to say, I'm sorry I hurt you, or to be able to say, I didn't mean it that way, or whatever it takes, and then even some of the ideas that Pete taught in that Twilight Zone episode idea to understand that this is not solving the problem. Right now, we're just trying to get the person's limbic system back online so that you can actually process together better. So you might ask, what would it help you to hear right now? And the partner might say, it would help me to hear that you don't really think I'm a big fat slob. Or it would help me to hear that you don't really hate my mother. Or, and so, and it's hard for a lot of couples to do this because some of these statements are so inflammatory, but you're driving home to them that what they're doing is that it is in the best interest of both of them and the relationship to calm, to create that sense of connection again. And that saying the words sometimes that the other person wants to hear is a kind of emotional salve. It's kind of putting out the fire that's in the brain. And nobody is expecting it to solve a problem. What it does is it brings them back to that kind of prefrontal cortex thinking. So one of the things I'm thinking, Michelle, well, first, we're nearly out of time, and I don't want to start on a whole other arena which has to do with what it really means to increase differentiation. Mm-hmm. So I think I'll start with, like, Claudia and Judy, if there's any last questions, and then open it up to the group for any questions, because I've covered a lot of stuff today. And so let's just take a time for a couple of questions before we sign off.
Claudia or Judy, do you have anything that you're wondering about, or should we open up the lines?
I have one question, Ellen and Michelle. Sometimes I find couples who are, you know, they're both working and life is complicated, and so regularity of attendance isn't always there. And it interrupts I feel like it interrupts the rhythm, and I'm just wondering about that. If anybody, you know, what your experience has been and how to deal with it.
No, it does interrupt the rhythm, and I do as much as possible to get them to come regularly, but I know it doesn't always work out. And I also, if the couple is not too competitive with each other, I prefer mm-hmm. to have one person come, even if the other person can't come, so that you can...
Yeah, I've been doing that, and that seems to be useful.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So I tell them I like to get as much continuity as
mm-hmm.
possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Michelle, I guess you could...
Okay, I'm going to open up the lines. Anybody has any questions, feel free to ask. Hi.
Hello.
If you're wondering about anything that you heard today, have any questions, now's the time to ask. Ellen's here.
Ellen?
Yeah?
This is Susan.
Hi, Susan.
And hi. I have a question. I have one couple that I'm seeing, and the man in the couple is just embedded in this place of hopelessness and helplessness, and he's extremely hostile, and I can't seem to mobilize him to take any accountability. Every time we start to move in that direction, he goes back to this place of saying, well, there's no point. His wife seems to be making some progress, but he certainly doesn't seem to be making it. Yet they continue to come on a regular basis.
I mean, I guess there's a couple of things that come to my mind. I mean, one is, the first thing would be to just assess his level of depression and whether that's a factor in his hopelessness.
Right.
But if not, then I would try to get a sense of when else in his life he's been helpless or hopeless before, and what did it take to get out of that, and what is he really looking for to begin to move beyond this helpless, hopeless position.
Right.
And one of the things we'll talk about in a later session, I know this won't help you right now, but is more about how to use and gestalt two chair work to look at those internal conflicts. And the hopeless, helpless position may be serving a function for him.
That's what I'm wondering about. Yeah. Okay. I'll think more about that, maybe write more about that on the blog.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure.
We have time for one more, Ellen?
Yeah, one more question or last, you know, if people want to make
any comments
or they hang up too.
Ellen, this is Gail. I do have a question.
Uh-huh.
My question is, I have a very hostile, angry couple that I've seen maybe three times, and I used this how to set boundaries in a conflict with them last night, actually, and he had struck me as pretty passive, pretty calm. And so at first I thought he was conflict avoidant and that she was angry and hostile. But when I did this conflict, boundaries of conflict, his fury just blew into the room because she chases him when he doesn't agree with her all over the house and he can't get her to stop. So we had a wonderful exercise about timeout and how that worked. And where I didn't understand before is how to bring him into acknowledging his pain, but that opened it wide open, and she was shocked to find out that he was injured by her chasing him. So my question was,
so first of all, three cheers for you for getting all that out in the open.
It was, my mouth almost fell open. I was amazed that just opened everything right up.
Mm-hmm.
But then what I'm worried about now is how to, what frightens me a little is they are leaving for Mexico for 2 months starting the 8th of January, and I'm really trying to figure out how to wrap it up in two sessions such that they don't re-injure one another. Would I move right into this amygdala, triggering, dueling amygdala thing, or do I go back to concentrating more on how to contain their conflict?
I think I would actually try to do two things. One is really educate them about the amygdala and educate them about understanding what the core triggers are for them. I mean, for him, you now have it clear that he can't stand it when she pursues him.
Right.
So that, and any time that he feels that kind of pursuit, he's going to get activated. So you have his already. We don't know. Maybe you know what hers is. But so you can educate them about it. You can make sure they know what each other's triggers are. You can ask them if for that break that they're going to have, if they're willing to say they're sorry to each other when they trigger each other. And to let them know that there's a lot of work for them to do when they come back. So I would
thank you. That helps me a lot, because what I was going to do is more, normally when that happens, I move into the eye to eye exercise,
right?
But I skip through these other two pieces, and I think that that's an enormous difference in how I'm working with couples. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think especially with them leaving, you don't want to open up a lot of eye to eye stuff right now.
Right, that's way too soon. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So
okay,
Michelle, let's just see if anybody, if anybody has comments.
I could ask a quick question. Is that okay, Ellen?
Yeah, one more. Yes.
This is Jean in Vermont. With my hostile dependent couple, it has felt too early to stick in a structured way to the I model. It seems like we need to use it at moments and then move away. It's difficult for them to stay with it. Does that make sense that might be the case with that kind of couple?
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely. I mean, part of what I'm stressing in this today is there's a lot of preparatory work, and particularly the hostile dependent couples have trouble handling the eye to eye initially because they need more preparation and more settling down and all of that first.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. I'm delighted and happy to hear you guys are experimenting and trying things and working with some of this material.
That's great.
And, Michelle, did you have anything before we go?
No, I don't. Just everybody have a good weekend, and we'll talk to you again on Monday.
Thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye.